But as I said, it is Tuesday morning, and what we do in the first hour every Tuesday morning is chat to the team from IT Financial Services, and we open the lines to you if you have any questions about your personal finance. Now is a great opportunity to take advantage of the near 250 collective years of wisdom here that sits on my right-hand side with Carly Tonkinson and Paul Larkin.
The topics discussed here tonight are general in nature, and you should seek personal advice before acting on any of this information. And now, on 2GB 873, The Bottom Line. Thanks to IT Financial Services. High-quality financial planning. Visit itfs.com.au.
Yes, 250 years might be a slight exaggeration, but when you put the whole IT team together, Carly and Chris, that's pretty close to the mark, isn't
pretty
it?
Pretty close. We might pop an admin person in there to build the numbers, but yeah, we're pretty close to
Why
that.
Why not? Throw one in, hey? Now, of course, from IT Financial Services, Carly Tonkinson and Paul Larkin, any questions people have about what anything to do with their personal finance in this hour, you'll...
Yeah, everything
absolutely.
And anything. Yeah, give us
try
a
try to answer.
Superannuation, investments outside of super, age pension... Yeah, anything.
Plenty around.
Within the finance realm.
Okay, well, if people have questions, 131873 is the number. We'll kick it off before the calls come in, guys, with the... Well, you've written some notes here, and it says, let's talk about the problem with relying on the bank of mum and dad. The problem is what?
So potentially not a problem for younger people benefiting from the bank of mum and dad, but particularly with the high house prices that we're seeing, increasingly parents are lending money to children or gifting money to children. So what we're actually seeing is people potentially getting into trouble either with the Centrelink rules, giving away too much and leaving themselves short for retirement, mm-hmm. or even trying to do the right thing by their children, but in fact not doing them any favours in the long run. So if you're having to lend a large amount of money to your children to buy a house, you have to ask yourself, can they afford that house anyway? Yes, you may be able to give them a lump sum now, but 2-3 years down the track as rates start going up, can they really afford the loan, 2 or 3 years on?
Because a lot of parents put up their own properties as collateral, don't they?
Yeah,
that's a risky strategy.
More common, much more common nowadays. Yeah, absolutely, risky strategy.
You'd want to love your kids if they stuff up their repayments.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, yeah, and it's not just them, of course. So in the future, their partners. So you're going to have to deal with that too. Something that we've seen come in recently, deposit bonds. So you just go guarantee for the actual deposit. So that's one way to limit your exposure. So potentially, if you've got other assets, you can still use your house as collateral. But if something does go wrong, you're only up for that 20%, say. Which can be really useful. It can help the sons or daughters avoid mortgage insurance, which can be $15,000 in certain cases.
Well, that is a big bugger, that insurance, the mortgage insurance.
Oh, the LMI, Lenders Mortgage Insurance.
Yeah. I mean, I understand why it was brought in, but that is a good chunk of a lot of people's deposit that they can't put on a deposit now because they've got to have that aside to pay the bank.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, and it's not protecting you. So you're paying a lot for insurance that protect you. It's just protecting the bank. Yeah. There is sense in it. They're just merely giving themselves that buffer. So that 80% borrowing ratio that most of us would see as standard, the bank's giving themselves basically a 20% price drop there. If they need to sell the property, they'll get their money back.
But, of course, in the past, you couldn't get a loan with anything other than 30% deposit, really, could you? I mean, so the banking rules have changed. They've become much more relaxed in the way they lend money. But at the same time, they're saying, well, because we're becoming relaxed, we're going to basically slug you a fee. I mean,
it's not so much the rules. It's what the banks are willing to do. We still see banks lending 100% for investment purposes, although they've cracked down on that quite a lot recently. So it's what the banks feel comfortable doing. But the mortgage insurance, 80-20 has pretty much been the standard in Australia for some time, and it's if you don't have that 20% deposit, mortgage insurance would certainly still apply.
Mm. On that issue... Paul, of the 100% loan from the bank for an investment property, if people came into ITFS and said, look, I've got this wonderful idea, I've seen a great property down in the Shire, 600,000, 700,000, it's going to be an investment, would you recommend I take out 100% of the loan? Would you say yes?
Oh, look, on the surface, probably not, but I mean, look, for investment purposes, securing 100% borrowings, if it's generally for that investment purpose and you know, after reviewing the client's income, I mean, 100% borrowings entitles you to 100% deduction on the interest on those borrowings. So, it can be a strategy that can work for the investor, and, you know, that's when we're getting into the negative gearing aspects. Mm. All that interest on the loan can be tax deductible, but... Look,
yeah, I think, you know, I mean, you would say yes if there's other debt. So yeah, it's about where you hold your debt, and that's where we talk about good debt and bad debt. So if you've got a home mortgage, you'd be better off holding cash there and borrowing the 100% for the investment because more of your debt, I mean, overall you'll still have the same amount of debt, but more of it will be tax deductible.
Okay, good point. 131873 is the number. Let's go and take a few calls here, guys. Anne's first on the phone. G'day, Anne.
Oh, hi.
You have Carly and Paul there. What's your question?
I hope I can make myself succinct and not belabor my question, but my question is that this year is the big year for my husband and I. We turn in 65. However, my husband turns 65 in the middle of January.
Mm-hmm.
We are concerned about, you hear all these rumors that so many things are going to change for your superannuation. We are not sufficient in our money that we're going to be a self-funded retiree without the help of the government.
Mm.
So should we start applying or put in work the paperwork so that by the middle of June we can say, hey, here we are, we're applying for the
age pension,
now without being then impacted with what the hell the rumours are going to be doing at the end of the financial year.
And you're not unfortunately able to put any applications in place prior to reaching age 65. So you can't apply for the age pension in advance.
Yes, you can by the middle of June, before the end of June.
When's your husband turning 65?
My husband will turn 65 by the middle of June.
Oh, by the middle, sorry, I thought middle of January. Mm. So, yeah, he can certainly put in the applications, and I believe 2 weeks prior to turning 65 you can submit the paperwork.
Yep.
But you're going to be subject to whatever rules apply at that time. So if we are thinking that there might be some changes to age pension in the budget, for example, in May, then any application in June is likely to be impacted by that.
Uh-huh.
That being said, there's already been a number of changes made to the age pension in recent times. There's some new changes coming in January 2017. So I'd be surprised to see the age pension rules change again in advance of those changes already coming in.
So you're saying, what are the new changes then are coming in May?
They've changed the assets test. So a lot of people with higher levels of assets will no longer be entitled to any age pension.
So, okay, let me throw in another question here. My property is sitting on the edge of Oran Park development there, which when it sits on the edge, I'm on 5 acres.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So therefore, it must mean that my property is valuable because I can put a number of houses on it, not that I'm going to because it would be worth nothing to me to do it, it cost me too much, I'm not a developer. But when you say the assets of my home...
If it's your own home, Anne, that remains exempt from the age pension assets test.
Aren't they talking about anything? But let me just go on about this. A neighbour who sold his place, who had 5 acres, sold it for $4.5 million.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm telling you, he's only next door to me. Doesn't that make me, you know, in that category of, you know, you've got too much money here?
Certainly, if you sold the property, Anne. And look, what you talk about is why there's always going to be, you know, certain people saying that your own home shouldn't be totally exempt because you are sitting on a rather large asset. But until you actually sell that asset and turn it into something else, so you know you sell it and put the cash in the bank or develop it into properties, that's not going to be assessed under the age pension under current rules. And I would say, look, it's going to be a brave government to make changes to that because you know, it is your own home, and if they do make changes, you've got a situation where people could be forced to sell their own home, and that's a pretty sensitive...
Trust me, if anyone comes to me and offers me $4.5 million, I will sell, and I'm happy to give.
And if you get that, Anne, I dare say you won't worry about the age pension.
Yeah, that's it, Anne. You'll have too much.
Right. Yeah. So, but get back to, should I be putting in the paperwork, making sure that we've got the paperwork in before the end of the financial year?
Well, you should be putting the paperwork in as soon as you reach age 65. So, if it's mid-June, that's the time to do the paperwork.
All right, Anne, thank you very much for the call. 131873 is the number. Hope that helped. Good morning, Richard.
G'day, guys. How are we?
Good, thank you. What's your question?
I've just got three questions. I'll firstly touch on my own self-managed super. And I have a self-managed super fund with, property. And I have about $200,000 debt in it, and the equity value is about $400,000. And personally, my wife and I own a property that's got about $700,000-$800,000 equity, and we've still got about $450,000 debt. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to work out whether I should. We want to buy another property, so I'm trying to work out whether we should just go and pay off the debt in the super, and then use that equity fully and purchase another property, or whether we should just go and expose our own personal balance sheet and have a property, in our name.
Richard, look, on your first point with using the equity inside the super fund to purchase a secondary property inside the super fund, is that what you're considering doing?
Yeah,
look,
right.
You're actually restricted with the self-managed super fund, you've got what's called a limited recourse borrowing arrangement, and you can't actually put in place a secondary limited recourse borrowing arrangement. So,
but if I pay off the existing one, would I be able to use that equity there fully? And if you know what I mean?
Yeah, look, it's something we'd have to check, Richard. You can give us a call during the week. But there's some pretty strict rules around continuations of borrowings inside the self-managed super fund.
No worries. And all right. And then just your thoughts on why the government here wouldn't allow people to use their super to, like in Singapore, I mean, you can use your, provident fund, as they call it, to purchase your own homes. And here, that's not the case. I'm just wondering whether that is something that's being discussed in the industry. Been lobbying for it? I mean,
I wouldn't think the industry itself has been lobbying for it. The reason is that Australia's superannuation system has what we call the sole purpose test, and that is that the investments must be to fund your retirement. I know that's very frustrating for people. You know, people have earlier priorities than retirement, but if they release those monies now for people to use to buy their own home or whatever it may be, where will the retirement funding come from, 40 years down the track? So I see the frustration, but really...
Different models, that's what
it's the sort of thing, certainly once you're approaching retirement or at retirement, you'll be glad that you've got those investments there, and it does allow you to make long-term growth-type investments, for your future. So I can see how people do get frustrated with it, but I do believe, it's there for a reason, and reason's pretty clear.
It's certainly been raised, as a fairly hot topic in recent times, being able to touch your super to purchase properties and certainly for younger people. But like Carly said, I think it really puts at risk your retirement funding.
Foreign, investors coming here and buying units for their children, and it's been... I mean, a parent here is, the common issue here for young kids here is they just can't simply accumulate the sort of money they need to accumulate to buy a property. So it is frustrating, and thank you for answering.
It is frustrating. Thanks, Richard.
Thank you for the call, Richard. Much appreciated. 131873 is the number. We'll take a break. Back with more in a sec. Tuesday morning talking finance with the team from IT Financial Services. Carly Tonkinson and Paul Larkin are in the studio taking your calls. Anything to do with your personal finance, 131873 to both of you. When people are reaching retirement and they're looking at their income stream in retirement, I mean, they have a few options, don't they?
Mm. Yeah, no, they do. Most people, at retirement, if you've got superannuation funds sitting there, you've got an option to, we're going to talk tonight about commencing an income stream from your super fund, and you've got an option to take what's called an annuity what's called an allocated pension, where you can actually draw on your super in the form of an income stream. So they're both income streams, but the fundamental difference with an annuity versus an allocated pension is that the allocated pension itself is exposed to the share market, In fact, you can invest your funds inside the allocated pension in secure investments that are not share market linked. But the annuity itself, you're giving your money to a company like Challenger, for example, the insurance company, and they'll pay you a set amount for a certain term.
So, provided they don't go bankrupt.
Correct, provided they don't go bankrupt. But what it does is creates, obviously, certainty for your regular payments. It gives people security that they know exactly what's coming in every month. And you can choose certain annuities where you'll actually get your capital back at the end of the certain term, or you can take what's called a lifetime annuity, where you're taking a bit of a punt with the annuity provider that you'll live a long time and you'll be paid that certain amount for the rest of your life. But the downside to annuities is, in this current environment, is that interest rates being so low, is that you're not going to get a fantastic return. Mm. You can take an annuity where they'll pay you an interest rate plus part of your capital over the term. But on the other side of the coin, choosing an allocated pension, you've got the ability to invest your funds in the market and keep up with inflation and actually grow your funds over time. So there's some options there that people need to consider, and you need to go and get some advice on what's the best option for you.
I think, yeah, it's worth pointing out, superannuation funds are actually very well protected from companies going bankrupt. And that would be the case if you use your super to start an annuity or using your super to start a pension.
Mm.
So the companies can't actually hold those assets on their balance sheets, as it were. So in the event that they were to go bust, the creditors aren't going to be coming attacking the funds. They're actually held, they need to have a trustee overseeing those funds separately. So I would say superannuation is as protected as it could be compared to other investments. So
right.
Don't sort of panic about that. But I think it comes down to choice and flexibility. So an annuity, you're locked in, it's fixed. Yes, you've got the comfort of knowing what's happening, but you're not going to usually have the benefit of withdrawing lump sums whenever you want to. Let's say that you lock it in an annuity and suffer ill health in 5 years' time.
Mm.
Do you really care that you've got this fixed income stream forever, or would you have liked the ability to take everything out and go around the world for a couple of years or whatever it may be?
Mm.
So you really are restricting yourself. I definitely wouldn't like to see anybody in 100% annuities at all. If you need some form of security, then potentially you could use part of the money for an annuity. But I think removing all flexibility for really the rest of your natural life is a big call.
Mm.
Talking about these sort of matters, are we looking at an average person that would use annuities, for example, or these allocated pensions? I mean, do you need to have a certain amount of money in your superannuation to start with, or in retirement to make this worthwhile?
No, look, I mean, to start an annuity, the minimum amount is $10,000 or $15,000. So it really comes down to, like we mentioned earlier, providing security for your payments in retirement. We have clients, and there's people out there who are very scared of the share market, and in times like these where it is quite volatile, knowing that you're getting your security of payment, is a comforting thing, and you know that your capital essentially is not at risk. But interestingly, inside a superannuation fund, there's super funds out there that you can choose a similar type safe investment, being a term deposit inside a super fund, where you get the same guaranteed return of income, and you'll get your capital back at the end of the period. But you don't have to actually take out an annuity product itself to give you that same sort of security. So there is flexibility with the investments inside a super fund.
So the only sort of benefit of going to the trouble of one of these, instead of just casually withdrawing money yourself out of a term deposit out of the bank, is tax advantage, is it?
Yeah, but if you're looking at that area where you've got fairly limited funds in retirement, the tax benefit probably doesn't exist because you're likely to be on a zero tax rate yourself. There's also costs associated with these things. So I agree, you're right there. But when is it really worth it? I mean, you put $10,000 in an annuity, you're probably getting less than $50 a month.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, what's the point?
You can go to the ATM and pull that out yourself.
That's it.
So I think, you need to approach it with some common sense. And I think the tax benefits associated with superannuation and retirement are fantastic, but it's definitely not a one-size-fits-all, because there's cases where maybe super is not the best option for you in retirement.
Mm.
Yeah, I mean, those cases, obviously, increasingly, as the older guard move on and the people who have had super most, if not all, of their life come through, well, then these sort of points won't be that important. But
definitely,
for a lot of people who are now retired who haven't had the benefit of super, certainly contributing towards super. Is there any way that they can in any way access it, or they pass the deadline because of their age to activate a self-managed super fund, for example, with some of their capital?
Well, it really comes down to, for people out there who don't have a super fund, you can start one as long as you're under the age of 65.
So that's the key, isn't it?
That's the key, yeah. You can contribute to a super fund. So if you've come into some money, you've never had super, you know, your whole life, and you're 63 years of age and you inherited some money, or you're wondering if you could start up a super fund, absolutely, you can go and do that. And you can contribute to the fund regardless of you're working or not. But once you're 65, you need to actually be working to make a contribution to start a super fund. And, you know, we've touched on this many times on the show. The benefits of super are the tax inside there. You know, you can hold numerous investments in there and pay minimal tax. But, yeah, certainly people who have been in a scheme for a number of years, they've got that added benefit of, you know, they've got their fund up and running. And, yeah, the option to commence a self-managed super fund is there all the time. And people... It's very popular nowadays to go into that space, but you need to get some good advice around whether it's worthwhile starting a self-managed super fund. But, yeah, there's some flexibility.
If you've already got money in super, you could be 85 and you can roll it into a self-managed super fund if that's the direction you want to go. So as long as it's already in the super environment, you can move in and out of self-managed super as much as you like. Once you're over 75, regardless, you know, you could be working 80 hours a week, but you can't contribute. So 75, I guess, is the cutoff, even if you are working. If you're over that age, really, you've left it too late to start.
Well, what about the rather elderly people that might be financially well off, but of course they never did super funds or anything like that? They have a diversity of investments, but they're not technically superannuation funds. As far as those individuals, minimising the amount of tax that they might be paying on those assets, what are the tricks for them? Say you're 86 or something like that, but you've still got a fair bit of capital around.
Sure, yeah.
It's outside of super.
Yeah, so, yeah, not being able to invest in super doesn't rule out investments. There's definitely still ways that you can do it. So one of the things, if you're looking at shares, target shares with fully franked dividends because they'll have a tax credit back. If you're looking at, you know, if you've got properties, the big problem tends to be less income and more capital gains tax issues. So if you've got, you know, quite a few assets, look at spacing sales over a number of years to reduce the amount of capital gains tax you'll have to pay. Look, it's pretty limited, I guess.
But for the sort of example of the person you gave then, who's 85 and never had a super fund, and they're, you know, they're sitting there with their investments and living off them in retirement. Yeah, like Carly said, I mean, to minimise tax there, you'd be well advised to target companies, shares that pay a franking credit, where you can minimise your tax. And in a lot of cases, there's a lot of people out there who don't pay any tax and they own a whole bunch of shares in on the Australian share market and receive, excellent income from those dividends and pay no tax. But, yeah, it's about getting the investments right and the structure right. But, yeah.
Older Australians also have additional tax offsets, so they can actually earn more than what you and I could earn and still pay no tax. So there's also a bit of benefit there.
Okay, terrific. We'll take a break. 131873 is the open line number. Any questions for either Carly or Paul about your personal finance or your circumstances, give us a call. 131873. We'll take calls after this break. It's 27 to 1 on 2GB, talking finance, your personal finance in this first hour with the team from IT Financial Services. Now, look, obviously understanding where you are financially can be daunting without IT Financial Services. What they do is they demystify financial jargon, they provide clarity to your goals and aspirations, they'll even help you develop your financial blueprint to work towards your lifestyle objectives. Be it from financial lifestyle coaching to financial risk profiling, strategies and investments to real-life financial solutions, just make one call to IT Financial Services on this number, 9258-7500. That's 9258-7500. Or go to itfs.com.au. IT Financial Services, Australia's own high-quality financial planning company. They can make a real difference to your financial future. IT Financial Services. The number again, jot it down, 9258-7500. Let's go back to the open line here. Deborah, g'day.
Oh, hello. How are you?
Well, Deborah.
just have a question for Carly and Paul.
Yes.
I'm always wondering if all allocated pensions are susceptible to the stock market.
No, Deborah. So you've got the choice of what you invest in inside your allocated pension. So if you like, you could have an allocated pension or account-based pensions, they call them now, just full of term deposits. Okay. So that won't move with the stock market.
It just depends on the provider, Deborah. Yeah.
Right. Well, I have an allocated pension and I thought that it was a guaranteed amount that I was going to receive forever that was just went up with CPI.
Yeah, look, it's a good point you raise because the allocated pensions, each financial year, depending on your age, you are required to receive a minimum amount of income. So the money that's paid out to you over the course of the financial year is a set required minimum amount, and that's based on your age. But in terms of the longevity of the capital inside the pension lasting, well, that depends on how you invest the money. So,
I just always was under the impression that an allocated pension was a better, a sort of more secure than an annuity.
Yeah, look, not necessarily. It comes back to the investments that are held inside the allocated pension. Like Carly mentioned, you can choose, depending on the fund that you go with, some funds out there will provide term deposits and cash where you can hold your money and you get the same sort of security that you would get with an annuity. But the point we're making is that the allocated pension, if you decide to choose investments like shares and property, well, you get the chance to actually grow your funds more than what you would through a specific annuity where your capital that you invest, generally speaking, it's paid back to you over time with a little bit of interest.
All right.
And it tends to run out over time unless you choose a certain term where you get you can take a term certain annuity where you can get 100% of your capital back, but you may not get paid very much.
The thing is, Deborah, depending on your age, there's a minimum amount that you must take out of your pension every year, and let's say that's 6% for some people. If you're invested in term deposits returning 3%, your fund is always going to go down.
All right.
Because you'll always be taking more than what the fund is earning. So you do have that choice, and if you've got an allocated pension now and you're not really sure what it's invested in, I would definitely be contacting them, find out exactly what you're invested in.
Okay.
You may need to make some changes.
All right. If it's in with the state super fund, you'd imagine that it would be fairly secure, wouldn't you?
Yeah, and as I said, I mean, all super funds are subject to the same regulations, so I think you can be fairly comfortable with those funds. With the state super, some of the older state super funds are defined benefit pensions, so they're different.
It would be the oldest state super fund.
Right, so it's possible that what you're talking about there is a defined benefit pension, and if that's the case, that is a set amount.
All right.
And that won't be subject to market fluctuations.
Okay. All right. I was just concerned when you first made the statement that allocated pensions were susceptible to changes in the stock market or fluctuations in the stock market.
Look, Deborah, what I'd suggest, I'd be able to answer the question for you very quickly. If you have a look at your statement or something, feel free to give the office a call tomorrow. If you just read me a couple of lines from your statement, I'll be able to tell you exactly whether or not you're in one of those pensions that will be affected by the market.
All right, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, Deborah.
Okay, bye.
Thank you for the call, Deborah. 131873 if you would like to make a call as well. Obviously, we found out recently that the RBA once again kept rates on hold at 2%, the cash rate. I mean, what does this mean for investors?
Well, at the moment, look, with rates being on hold, I mean, we've seen, rates at these levels and they've kept them on hold the last, for how long now?
It's a long time.
A long time. But in terms of investments and options outside of money being held in the bank, because with the cash rate being so low, the banks have obviously tended to keep their deposit rates very low. It's kept mortgage rates low, which is great for home borrowers. But people, as a general rule of thumb, because you can't get a great return in the bank, it's the options are there to invest in shares in the stock market. And that, over the last, 6 to 12 months, we've seen investors chasing income dividends from shares. And, we have seen the last 6 to 12 months, the stock market has gone backwards. It's been quite volatile. But companies like the banks, for example, and Telstra, they pay excellent dividends. So, you know, what's the current interest rate being on held going to do to, you know, future returns? Well, it's impossible to know, but, you know, as a general rule of thumb, it may push the stock market prices up a little bit more over time.
And keep in mind, I mean, that's what they do. I mean, that's what interest rate movements are for. Low interest rate environments are meant to stimulate the economy. So it should make businesses more profitable. Business borrowing is cheaper. Business investment tends to be
That's
easier.
If the bank lends to your business.
Well, if
they've got any money left after all the mortgages they've been getting.
So realistically, it should be a positive. And as Paul said, you do tend to see more money moving into the stock market during the low interest rate environment. I think the other thing, I mean, we've seen the Australian dollar increase quite a lot over the last week, so that will be interesting to see. I mean, certainly that's been the Reserve Bank's biggest concern drops that we've had in the rate has been really in response to the Australian dollar. So I'm not sure how comfortable they would be to see that going back up again. Inflation is also really low. So I think those sort of key areas point to the fact that we won't see rates go up for some time.
And our stock market's actually had a bit of a rally the last week or so on some good news on the GDP figures last week. We're actually better than expected. So We've seen a pretty good rally in the stock market the last 6 or 7 days, which has put a smile on investors' faces, no doubt, because it's been a bit doom and gloom the last 6 to 12 months. So, hopefully we're seeing a bit of a turn there in the fortunes on stock markets. But, you know, for investors out there worried about their super funds and how their money, you know, is going to fare over time, you know, the key there is to get a solid portfolio set up and review it. Get it reviewed, you know, regularly with your advisor, and make sure you've got your investments positioned in the right asset classes, because, you know, the asset classes will move differently in different economic times, and that's what we've seen the last few years, certainly with international shares versus Australian shares. The returns have been varied. So, yeah, it's about reviewing your investment choices and your options and trying to make your money last as best as it can.
It's tough on the self-funded retirees, though, these sort of things. A lot of people with money, term deposits and things like this, they're doing the right thing. They're trying to avoid the pension, help the taxpayer out, and they see the interest rate so very, very low.
Yeah, and times like this, they're being hit from both sides. So if they're in the stock market, the stocks are obviously had a difficult year, and if they're in term deposits, they're not getting much return. So, yeah, it's hard.
Let's take a couple more calls. 131873. Hello, Jane.
Hello. I'd like to ask Carly and Paul. Apparently, the RBA is thinking of going into digital currency like Bitcoin. I hadn't really heard very much about it. Do either of you know anything what they've got in mind?
I'm going to pass that one to Paul.
Yeah, no, I've got to be honest. Jane, I don't know. I haven't heard of those rumours. No, I don't know.
Okay.
Jane, were they looking at going to something like Bitcoin, or were they making the point that with time they thought that coinage and banknotes, that is a tangible currency, may be phased out as we see more sort of tap and go debit transactions and things like that?
I wish I knew, Michael. That's why I'm asking your guests, because there hasn't been very much about I just read a two-sentence paragraph, and that was it. And there was enough to create interest, but I'll have to look into that further.
Yeah, we'll look into that too, Jane, because it's that's created some interest in me too.
Yeah, well, thank you, Jane. In regard to Jane's question, though, more broadly speaking, I mean, obviously a lot of people don't use cash anymore. Everything is done on a card, but there is potential security concern with that, isn't there? I mean, people have to be a little careful with all of this internet banking and just tapping things and
Yeah, and there's so many different aspects. You need to be careful with the fees that you're paying. You need to be careful to keep an eye on your statements and make sure that there's not transactions going through there that you're not aware of. You need to be careful from a budgeting point of view because it doesn't really seem like money when you're just tapping
your
card.
Well, that's the point, isn't it? I mean, it's easy to go to the fruit shop and just go, dump, and there's $70 gone. You don't actually open the wallet to physically take the money out, to count it, to feel it, to hand it over, and you just sort of keep tapping away unless you check your balance. Well, half the time you don't know how much you got there.
Yeah. And that sounds like such a small thing, but it's huge. And really, when we look at particularly younger people trying to accumulate wealth, that's the first thing you're looking at, how much you're spending. So if you're just tapping everything, you've got no idea what you're spending, that's a real challenge for people trying to build assets.
Mm. Yeah, we're in the pay pass world, and, it's under $100. There you go, tap and go. You've got to be mindful of what you're spending.
But everything these days seems to be the credit world. The days of lay-by seem almost vanished, don't they? Everyone buys something on the never-never.
Yeah. And again, it's that same thing. It doesn't feel like you're paying for it, and that's the problem. And that just can spiral out of control very, very quickly. So alarming figures about the age that people are getting credit cards and the limit, like credit limits that they're getting, is just astronomical. So, and I think particularly if you get into debt at that young age, it takes a very, very long time to get ahead of things again. And if you've got credit card debt at the age of 20, and then you're 25, nearly 30 before you pay it off, you're way behind on things like saving for a deposit for a home loan. And I mean, it really does. It seems like such a small thing when you're 20, but it can have a flow-on effect for a lot of things later on.
Do you ever advise people not to take credit cards, even if they don't have one and they're offered one? Do you ever say, look, you're not in a position to have a credit card?
Yeah, all the time.
How does that go down? I don't have one, I'm one of the rare people. I don't have
very good, Michael.
I think particularly now with Visa debit, it's hard to make an argument as to why you would have it. I'll look at all the reward points you get. Well, there's only so many new toasters you can get. I mean, reward points really are not worth very much
most
at all.
Most of that's nonsense anyway, isn't it?
Exactly. So I don't think that's a good reason. I'll often advise people not to do it or to reduce credit card limits, to pay off credit cards when they're sitting there with money in the bank. It's just, again, I think it's more of a mental thing for most people. But
If you're disciplined though with your repayments, I mean, it is a it's a smart strategy to use your offset account and hold your money inside the offset account for as long as possible, and you can pay for your bills and expenses on your credit card, but before the interest free period expires, make a payment on your credit card from the offset account so that you're offsetting the interest on your mortgage, but you're not paying any extra interest on the credit card, but you've just got to be disciplined in paying off the credit card when it's due.
You do need to be disciplined. And offset accounts, when I use one myself, I think they are fantastic, but if you're not a disciplined person, an offset account can be the worst thing in the world for you. So don't assume that everybody's got an offset account, so that will work for me too. If you're just going to spend all the money in it, you're probably paying more fees than you have to, and really no benefit whatsoever, and probably running up a credit card bill that won't get paid off every month as intended in the meantime.
And how many people wander through your doors that have multiple credit cards, and credit card A pays off credit card B, and credit card B pays off the debt on credit card C?
Yeah, no, we see it a lot.
I think...
How do people get in that position?
You spend a lot on one and then you've got those minimum payments due. I think these balance transfers have contributed a lot to that, and these 0% balance transfer. The problem is you just keep transferring to these 0% cards. That goes on your credit report. Gets out of control really quickly.
Mm. Okay. Kylie, good morning.
Hi, Michael. Hi, Carly and Paul.
Good morning.
Hi.
Hi. I've just got a couple of points. Firstly, I'm about in the process of rolling over my super into a self-managed super fund.
Yeah.
Right.
I have a few. So, and it's about $175,000. My question is, am I able to run a business through it, so that I work for the super fund?
No. No. So, again, it comes back to that sole purpose test. So a super fund can't be actually seen to be carrying on a business. And that even goes down to a super fund can't be seen to be professional share traders. So even if it's not strictly a business, it's share trading, even that can actually get you into a bit of trouble. So you definitely can't use any of that money for anything other than investment for your retirement.
Right.
And it needs to be genuine investment. It can't be... You know, I'm investing in myself, as it were.
Yeah, no, I've got a sort of a business idea that I want to do, that I will be funding other people, sort of retirees, to do something for themselves. So, yeah, and I just wasn't sure if I just have it completely separate from the super fund.
Well, you would need to, Kylie. If you start mixing those things together, you'd be risking your fund being non-compliant, and that has a whole lot of tax implications as well as fines attached. So just be very, very careful with that.
I have got a financial advisor doing it all with me.
Fantastic.
I'm just trying to get different points of view.
Yeah. Look, it's not even really a point of view. It's pretty black and white, the law on that. And look, one of the biggest scams going around at the moment is related to self-managed super funds and funds... You know, people advising people to take out funds when they really shouldn't be. So just be very cautious. Double check. The ATO has some great information for self-managed super fund trustees.
A lot of that. I'm also going to go to one of the info nights they've advertised recently in town next week. Now, when you have, you can only have four trustees, and they can only be family. If they're working for you, they can only be family. Is that right?
Yes.
That's right. Okay. And you don't have to have any more than, like, yourself. You can just do it all yourself, can't you?
You can't have a single trustee, so you can't be an individual single trustee. If it's individual trustees, there needs to be at least two. Otherwise, you'd be looking at a corporate trustee structure.
Corporate trustee, yeah, cool. Okay, well, that's been... Oh, I just wanted to say, because I have been looking at my super quite a bit in the last 12 months or so, and I've been paying super since I started work, basically. Even when I did fruit picking, I had to pay super. And with the balance I've got, and they did an estimate of, I don't think people really realise how important it is. I'm still, with what I've got, if I want to live on 60K a year in retirement with 20 years to put into my super, give or take, I still need to be putting in close to $2,000 a week to have that, you know, lifestyle of $60,000 income.
And look, if you work with an advisor, hopefully they've gone through some numbers with you. The problem is with these long-term projections, you change one number, such as the investment return, you know, in a tiny way, and the whole thing is completely different. But I'd just say, look, with any of those sort of projections, be a little bit conservative on what you're expecting the returns to be, and make sure you're factoring in what the employer's putting in and tax benefits, etc.
Yeah, I think that's just on top of what I'm already putting in. But, yeah, I had no sort of concept of, you know, you put super in every week and you don't see anything for it. Even, you know, it seems so far away.
Well, yeah, that's right. And it's why, usually when they make adverse changes to super, it's usually in that lower age group because people just don't connect with it.
No.
All right, Kylie. Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for taking
the time to call. Bye-bye. 131873 is the number. It's 8 minutes to 1. We can fit probably one or two more calls in if you have financial queries. We'll be back in a sec. 131873, talking personal finance for another 6 or so minutes here with Kylie Tonkinson and Paul Larkin from IT Financial Services. To both of you, an email just came in asking, when applying for the age pension, one of the questions is, have you given away any assets in the past 5 years? Now, the emailer wants to know, if you have given away any assets in the past 5 years, how does this impact on your entitlement?
Yeah, so that question in the application, everybody has to answer it. It's directly relating to gifting. So with essentially, to clarify, you can give away as much as you want. You could give away everything tomorrow, no problem. Nobody's going to tell you not to. But when Centrelink assess how much age pension you may be entitled to, they have limits on how much they'll reduce your assets by. So it's $10,000 per financial year or $30,000 capped over a five-year period. So 5 years is the magic number of years. If you're 60 and you're looking to apply for the age pension, but you are going to give away assets, so say, for example, where we're talking about, you know, lending money to kids for, or whatever it may be, you want to be doing that sort of 5 years in advance of applying for the pension. Otherwise, you know, it will still be counted as an asset.
Well, you talk about giving away assets or whatever. I mean, obviously, cash in a bank account is an asset, isn't it?
Yeah, or property. Or
so if you, for Christmas, go and buy your 45-year-old son a Lamborghini, that's a Christmas present. Does that count?
Yeah, I believe it would. I think, I mean, look, it comes down to in the spirit of it, I guess. You know, are you regularly giving Lamborghinis for Christmas? If you are, I mean, look, if, quite frankly, if you can afford to give that away as a gift, you're probably not getting the pension anyway. So,
But yeah, look, if you're spending money on the home, you're buying a fridge, or you're up doing upkeep on the home. I mean, these types of things. Look, you're adding to your home asset, so no, that's not considered. You know, you're obviously not gifting it to your children. I think you're just spending money on your home. But, yeah, you've just got to be careful with, like Cully said, if you're going to gift assets or significant amounts of money, you'd be well advised to do it 4 to 5 years out from being eligible for the age pension.
If you give $100,000, let's say your parents gave you $100,000 tomorrow, then applied for the pension, Centrelink would say, okay, well, we'll let you gift 10, that's fine, but we're still going to act as though you've got $90,000 sitting in the bank. So that's how it works. So even though you can give away as much as you like, Centrelink will still count most of it.
Right, okay.
For that 5-year period.
Yeah. So, I mean, the only reason I ask further on to this email's point is that it does seem like you could work your way around it somehow. If you had a half-smart lawyer, I don't know why people would want to end up on the age pension if they have a lot of money, but... You know, a lot of people have a lot in super, but then they go and pay down their mortgage when they hit retirement and get on the age pension. So people do manipulate the system.
Yeah, I think you need to be very careful there. If you're 60 and your one obsession is to get on the age pension and you decide to give away all your assets, I mean, that's pretty brave to me. You want to be hoping your children...
It's not on a lot of people's bucket list, is it?
I don't think so. No. And that's, yeah, in reality, who would really do that? You know, you do risk not getting the money back.
Okay, take a quick break. Back with more in just a sec. One, now with IT Financial Services, you can look forward to a brighter financial future. IT Financial Services works with you in partnership to help you achieve your goals and to secure your financial future. Over almost 30 years, their advisors have helped thousands of people from all walks of life with everything from superannuation and investments to insurances and debt management. You see, it's never too early to start your financial journey. Just make one call to the team at IT Financial Services on 9258 7500 or visit their website at itfs.com.au to get started. IT Financial Services is Australia's own high-quality financial planning company. The number 9258 7500. Well, to both of you, thank you once again for coming in.
Thank
another
you,
week at these very early hours.
Thanks, Michael.
It's not taking a toll on you by the look of it, thankfully.
Just the 1 hour for us, a little bit longer for you.
Yes, indeed. Now, of course, IT Financial Services back again next week.
Yes, I think Chris and I think we've got an accountant coming in next week, so talking about a bit of tax stuff. So any tax questions next week?
Beautiful. Terrific. Well, you guys have a lovely week. Thanks
Thank
so much.
You
Thanks, Michael. Same to you.
ITFS back with you again same time next week. Coming